This is wonderful. I'd like to thank Jim for the invitation to come here. Thank you very much. Good friend on the path. We're going to talk about that tonight. Thank you to the Bechets. Where are you? Yes, over here, for opening their home to me this weekend. Good rest, good company, good food. It was wonderful. Thank you very much, both of you. A thank you and apology to Dora Lee. Every doshi is different, right? And so my apologies for, totally, not giving you good cues on where to ring the bell. So it's my fault. Anyway, so a beautiful job following someone who, didn't do it the way you expected. So thank you. Anyway, appreciate your graciousness and lovely bells, by the way. So it's nice to be here with you. I'd like to talk with you this evening about wisdom, compassion, and good friends on the path. These are sort of some of the pillars of Zen Buddhism. But instead of talking to you about them sort of philosophically, I'm going to give a couple of definitions, but instead of talking about them rather philosophically, what I would like to do is bring them alive for you by talking with you about three real people in the Buddha's time, in the original Buddha's Sangha, that we have some information about, that about their lives that embodied these. I think these concepts are often easier if we can put a face with them or a bio with them, and it kind of brings it alive. So I will talk about these three people. They are in our chant. When we chant the ancestors, all three of them, you will find them in there. And let me just define briefly what Zen Buddhism means by what I think they embody. Compassion, wisdom, and good friends on the path. Compassion is a cornerstone of Buddhism. It is an active effort to reduce suffering. An active effort to reduce suffering. Now, notice I didn't say an active effort that reduces suffering. Okay? We can never be sure of the outcome, of the result. So what we can be sure about is our intention. So compassion is about an intention to reduce suffering in the world, or at least to not make things worse. So typically the bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara or Kuan Yin, both male and female, meaning everybody gets to do this and can do it, is depicted with 1,000 arms and hand and eyes, with an eyeball in each hand. And so she is able to help, but also is a witness. She just listens. And sometimes the most compassionate thing we can do is just listen and just be there. So this is compassion. Wisdom is many things that are not tonight's talk, that are whole study periods of themselves, impermanence, emptiness, all these awful words. It's like, what is that? What is emptiness? What is impermanence? What is no self? All the scary words in Buddhism kind of land in the wisdom in the wisdom category. But basically, wisdom is understanding thoroughly how we cause suffering, often for ourselves, and then it radiates out for others by clinging, by expecting things to be permanent, by thinking that I or you have a permanent self, and then we lock in to that. So wisdom is the thorough study of non-discrimination, of not picking and choosing. And a good friend on the path, a Kalyana Mitra. Mitra being the word that means friend. It's related to metta, which is maitri in Pali. I'm sorry, in Sanskrit. So a Kali. Kali is still the Greek word in modern Greek for good or well. So a Kalyana Mitra, a good friend on the path, helps wisdom and compassion from being lonely. And especially when we think we can't do those two things, We have Kalyana Mitra, Good Friends on the Path. A lot of Kalyana Mitras is a sangha. Okay. But a Kalyana Mitra is a good friend that doesn't turn away from us, that stays with us even in the dark times. So briefly, those are the classic definitions in Buddhism of wisdom, compassion, and Kalyana Mitra. And I would like to bring those alive for you about what we know about three people who were in the Buddha's original Sangha, meaning they knew him, and what we know about them, which in some cases isn't much. So we're going to just go with what we have, and what the description, what the sutras, and what some of the surviving histories tell us about these people. The first person I would like you to meet is the embodiment of compassion. This person was a teenager, according to the texts at the time, the extant writings of people at the time, and also according to the sutras. Her name was Sujata. Sujata was a daughter of a landowner. And she was walking along the riverbank on her father's land one day and happened to look down in the river and saw a very filthy, very emaciated man lying half out of the river. And she didn't know who this was, but she kind of got it about compassion and understood this even as a teenager. And went down to help the man who was dying of starvation. And she learned the man's story that he had been trying for 6 years all kinds of ascetic practices, and eventually to the point of, so the story goes, of eating only one sesame seed a day. So he was starving. He had gone down to the riverbank to see if he could get some water. And he hadn't been able to get back up from the riverbank. She did not know at the time that this was the former Prince Shakyamuni, who had left home 6 years ago and would eventually become the Buddha. All she knew was that this man was in terrible trouble and was dying in front of her. So she helped him get up to the riverbank. And she happened to have some rice milk with her, which was a good thing because that was probably about the only thing he could have digested at this point since his gastrointestinal system had pretty much shut down from no food. And she nursed him and stayed with him and fed him and brought him back to enough strength that he could go on. And after having been resuscitated literally by Sujata, he realized that all of these ascetic practices that he had done for 6 years, trying to become enlightened, trying to find the end of suffering, all those ascetic practices were just suffering on top of suffering. And he wasn't going to do those anymore. And he left Sujata and went to sit under a tree with the vow that he would sit there until he understood the cause and the end of suffering because he had seen so much of it in his life. So Sujata saved his life. She eventually learned who he was and became a very constant and devoted member of his sangha when he became the Buddha. So this was Sujata, the embodiment of compassion that says, it doesn't matter to me who you are. I'm not going to discriminate. You're in trouble, and I will actively help you and be with you, and be with you. Not with the idea to fix you and send you on your way, but to accompany. Accompany. Another word for compassion actually is accompaniment. Accompaniment. To be with. So Sujata is a lovely example in our ancestors of someone who was living this idea that the Buddha would then take and make a major part of his teaching. Well, how did the prince get to the riverbank? What happened 6 years before? So 6 years before, the prince had left the palace and left his wife, Yasodhara, and their newborn child. Now, here's where our current judgment and sensibility really goes off the rails with this story. So what I would like to do is give you the story according to the sutras and the stories of the Buddha's time, and please take this forward and correct everybody, okay? Because the typical reaction to the prince leaving his wife and newborn son is, how could he do that? What a miserable husband and father. This is usually what people say, right? What this miserable husband and father, brand new kid, right, runs off and leaves his wife. Well, not according to mountains of Buddhist literature, some of which was from people at the time. So here's the corrected, edited version. Okay, please feel free to take this forward. In the Jataka tales, Jati is the Sanskrit word for birth, and the Jataka tales are the tales of all of the past lives that the Buddha remembered. This is one of the hallmarks of a Buddha, is that they can remember many past lives. Other people can too, but you don't have to be a Buddha to remember past lives, but Buddhas can remember many. And in the Jataka tales, the Buddha remembers hundreds of past lives. And in several of those, he has a companion who eventually ends up being Yasodhara, his wife, in the life in which he became the Buddha. But she was his Kalyanamitra, his good friend on the path through several lives. And they would get to various lives and remember that they had been friends before. They weren't always a married couple, but they were always companions on the path, progressively waking up together. And so the Jataka tales, and then coming over into some of the sutras, say, Yasodhara's Sutra, I highly recommend it. It's a very touching story about Yasodhara. In the penultimate life before their lives as Prince Shakyamuni and Yasodhara, they had realized that they were both about ready to wake up. And they had an agreement. They came to an agreement that he would go first. So when he walks out of the palace to leave and take up the ascetic practices, he's going with her blessing and full knowledge and agreement. He's going with her full knowledge of what he's about to do, and they're crossing their fingers that this is going to happen in this lifetime. And then it does. And then it does. And Yasodhara and their son, Rahula, join the Buddha's order. And if you ever needed an example of forgiveness, if you were thinking that he had up and left her and the kid, the fact that the wife and the son came back to be full members of his sangha is pretty clear evidence that if there was any forgiving to be done, she certainly did it. But it was more the fulfillment of the agreement that he would go first, but she would still be there as his Kalyanamitra, his good friend on the path. And Yasodhara was that. She was a leading teacher in the Sangha. And both Yasodhara and Rahula, their son, died before the Buddha. At their deaths, the Buddha predicted that they would both eventually become Buddhas. And in a few of the sutras, there is speculation that she is the next Buddha, Maitreya, Buddha of future birth, that the next Buddha is the next iteration of Yasodhara, fulfilling the agreement that they had that he would go first, and then she would be next. And it's very interesting that the name of the future Buddha is Maitreya, which is a version of Mitra or Maitri, kindness, compassion, which is also the root of friend, Maitreya, Mitra. It's very interesting that the person who was his Kalyana Mitra becomes Maitreya Buddha. There is some speculation in some of the sutras that she's next. She's the next one. So Yasodhara is the Kalyana Mitra, the embodiment of the good friend on the path that stays with you not only year after year, but lifetime after lifetime, and vows to stay with you, and then vows to let you leave and support that so that you can fulfill the vow that you both made. Yasodhara, a Kalyana Mitra, a good friend on the path, the wife of the prince, and the follower, willing, devoted follower of the Buddha. There's this very touching story where the prince's father, King Suddhodana, is pressing Rahula, the son, to go get his inheritance, to go get his, because it's the grandson of the king is Rahula, the Buddha's son, and Yasodhara is tired of the king nagging that the son needs to get his inheritance. Of course, the king is thinking the palace, the whole stuff we saw, you know, all the pomp and circumstance we saw last weekend, right, in the royal wedding, right, all of that, you know, all that stuff. And the king is thinking that that's what he's going to give Rahula. So Yasodhara is tired of this, so tired of the king nagging the grandson. And so Yasodhara says to Rahula, says, please go to your father and get your inheritance. And Rahula goes to his father, who is the Buddha at this point, and asks for his inheritance, and the Buddha ordains him on the spot. Oops. Oops. We don't know what King Suddhodana's reaction to that is. You can speculate all you want. So interesting. Yasodhara, supporting her Kalyana Mitra, being both of them being good friends on the path to the point of enlightenment. Wow, what a nice support. So the third embodiment, this is the embodiment of wisdom, Mahapajapati, the Buddha's aunt who raised him. His mother died several days after he was born. His aunt, Pajapati, raised him, and when he became the Buddha, she became the first female member of his Sangha, just joined right in, right away, in supporting him. And several years into this, having watched several people become ordained, Mahapajapati went to the Buddha and said, I'd like to be ordained too. And the Buddha said, Mahapajapati, please don't ask. Women can't do this part. So sort of apocryphally, she asked three times, right? In all these stories, you know, they asked three times and got the same answer. Please don't ask, Mahapajapati, please don't ask. Women can't be ordained. So Mahapajapati, not to give up, went to Ananda, who was the sort of the jisha, if you will, the attendant, the close attendant of the Buddha, and pled her case to Ananda. And Ananda was like, well, of course. So he went to the Buddha. Ananda went to the Buddha and said, and started by a very interesting piece of logic, and didn't even start with Mahapajapati, but started by saying, Buddha, is it not true that all beings are capable of enlightenment? And the Buddha said, well, of course, all beings are capable of enlightenment. And then, of course, Ananda had him, right, and said, well, that means women, too. And the Buddha was like, oops. Right. So Ananda said, so you need to ordain Mahapajapati, because you just told me that all beings can become enlightened. So let's not get exclusive here. And it's the only recorded time of the Buddha ever changing his mind. The only recorded time. And Mahapajapati was ordained. 2,500 years later, Patty and I and others are sitting here with Rakusus and able to participate fully in this practice because Mahapajapati, in her wisdom, reminded the Buddha that wisdom is a non-discriminatory practice and that all beings are capable of enlightenment and awakening. So we have these three people who were real, who lived at the Buddha's time and knew him, two of whom were related to him. Sujata saved his life, not knowing who he was, with her compassion. Yasodhara accompanied him through lifetimes and did not turn away, even when he left for 6 years. She came right back to be with him, to be a Kalyanamitra, to stay in that role. And Mahapajapati, who reminded him in a moment of probably some cultural forgetfulness, that all beings without exception, are capable of enlightenment fully. Compassion, wisdom, and Kalyanamitra. Who are those people in your lives? And who are you for them? Thank you. We have some time for questions or comments. And microphones are coming around.
I had not heard the story that there's a possibility that Yasodhara is Maitreya.
Maitreya Buddha, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So would that be the first female Buddha, if that's true? If
not,
a Buddha actually has a gender,
yeah.
But...
So I think this is a radical invitation to not genderize Buddhas.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
That actually makes me wonder, in the classic tales of Buddhism, do people stay one gender through transmigration, or do they flip-flop?
No, they don't. The Jataka tales are really interesting, are really fun to read. Not only do people not stay the same gender, they're not always human. In several of those, the Buddha is a deer, is a bird, and the other people in his entourage, both male and female, at least male and female, as they ended up in the human life, are various animal protectors, spirits, you name it. Okay, it's all kinds of stuff. With the idea, these tales are lovely to read. They're not very long, kind of bedtime stories, if you will. But at the end of each one, the Buddha gives it away and tells you who he was in that story. Okay, and will tell you who Ananda was and who Yasodhara was, and it's not only not always a gender, it's not always, in many cases, not always human. Yeah. Uh-huh. Tree once, right, yes. Uh-huh. Right, yeah, thank you. Good evening.
Good evening. There's a wonderful portion in the Vimalakirti Sutra where, so the Vimalakirti Sutra is probably the primary sutra about a layperson,
yes,
preaching the Dharma. And at one point, a goddess appears, and one of the disciples, I forget who.
It's Manjushri
says, wait a second, you can't be enlightened because you're a woman. And she goes, poof, and turns him into a woman.
Woman.
And he says, so, is there any male? Is there any female? He says, turn me back, turn me back.
Yeah, the Naga princess. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, there's another Soma, another member of the Buddha's Sangha, the contemporary of the Buddha, a nun in his Sangha. A lovely story about her. She's sitting under a tree in meditation one day during one of the practice periods during the fall rainy season, and Mara shows up. All right, Mara, the trickster in Buddhism, and Mara shows up and says, what do you think you're doing? You women can't, you know, be enlightened. And Soma says, I have my heart set on liberation, which is not a gender. Now get out of here. So, yeah. Yeah. Oscar. So everybody can hear. Thank you.
Nowadays, it's not so intuitive for Westerners, perhaps, to think about past lives or to believe in the continuity of something. Mm-hmm. What's your take on that in terms of where the theory or the idea of the continuity of lives fits in modern practice in Zen?
Thank you. Okay, that's a good question. So I'm going to give you my personal answer to this past lives deal, and then I'm going to make a more practical suggestion. Okay. I say this with some hesitation, but I'm going to say it anyway. I actually have remembrance of past lives. And the previous iteration was somebody who had, on his death, a heart-wrenching wish for a spiritual life. So that's my experience. Okay. I have some remembrance of that, and or whatever you want, whatever the words get tricky, okay, at this point. But I find this very both comforting and encouraging that this iteration is fulfilling a heartfelt inmost request of a previous iteration, and that actually makes a lot of things in about this life for me really easy, because it's a fulfillment, like Yasodhara and the prince had. So I'm just going to leave that out there, okay, that in my own personal experience, I have some experience of this, okay. I'm not here to convince you that this is true. It's my experience, and it may not be yours. And I'm not here to convince you that there are past lives. So let me take this into a more practical standpoint. Who were you yesterday? How about the past life of yesterday? And how about how yesterday set up who you are sitting right here? And what does Sunday Oscar have to do with Monday Oscar or last year or something like that? And can you see the connection between you, self, using that term very loosely, all right, but this energetic, if you will, if not bodily form, but at least energetically, who you might have been a year ago and how that set you up for who you are sitting here this evening. So it's fine to let go of the whole past lives deal, okay? And, you know, and to say that, it could be that all of the hundreds of past lives that the Buddha remembered were each a month long in his, you know, who knows? I don't know what the time difference is here. But if you're not, if you don't want to go to the past lives in the sense that the Buddha was telling the story in the Jataka tales, then examine who you were last week or last month and watch how that sets up who you are right now. So here's why this is helpful. Because next week, you're going to be somebody different. Not a lot, maybe. But we heard about somebody tonight who broke a vertebra. That's a seriously different person. And the person who got hit by the car, Karen, I'm so sorry. That happened. Sorry. But they're a different person. And what we need to be able to do is let go of that label of stepmom, because it's not the same, is it? It's not the same person. It's not the same person, but we cling to that. But what we can do is we can watch how we are one moment sets up the next moment. And in some cases, we can choose who we're going to be. When we have a broken vertebrae and get hit by a car, we don't get to choose. But when we aren't in those emergencies, we get to choose who we are tomorrow. And the Buddha's message is that this is the crux of the reduction of suffering, is the choice of the intention and the effort that we're going to make given the current body that we have. Long answer to your question, but anyway, so... I know Zen teachers who remember past lives and Zen teachers who don't remember past lives. And I would say that many of them operate on this principle of who was I last week and who do I want to be next week, and can I be a kind, compassionate, wise Kalyana Mitra next week, please? Or next lifetime. Okay. Yeah. Hi, Jim.
It's a red.
Red. Red. Oh,
there you go. Yeah, that's good. Alive.
Okay. Sorry. Oh, it's still working though. Oh,
give me the other one. This one's green.
Okay. So anyway, I met someone here in Sacramento, and by process of some random remembrance of names, we realized that we went to elementary school together in Richmond, California. Mm. And today this person sent me pictures, class pictures of him and me from the second to the sixth grade. In our class pictures in this school. And I look at the picture of myself, and there's as much discontinuity as there is continuity. So I can't really say whether there's continuity in this life, let alone continuity,
yeah.
You know, in another life.
Yeah.
I mean, the pictures tell me there's continuity, but the mind doesn't really remember being in those pictures or, you know, any very much at all about that period of life, which was, you know, a long time ago.
Yeah.
So I don't know what that is relevant to, but I thought I'd bring it up since I got these pictures today.
Yeah. We have some influence over who we are next. I think that's kind of the idea here. And next... You get to. We can define what we want to think of as next, but we have some influence over that. Yes. Hi. Good evening.
Good evening. So we spent all day Saturday remembering my grandfather who passed away last week.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. But one of the interesting stories that my father told during the eulogy was how my grandfather believed he was born 100 years too late. Basically, he grew up in Orland, and even at age three, he was a cowboy. And he grew on to become, you know, a sheriff at Butte County, and he was the epitome of the cowboy. And it's so funny because just thinking back to the what you're saying about how you can choose who you become, he basically, even though he lived in the 21st century, he, in his mind, he was still a cowboy. Mm-hmm. And so I guess sometimes you can choose who you want to become, and then you can choose who you want to be, just, you know, embracing his own self. And I think in true fashion, he wasn't super religious. So for his memorial, they put in Frank Sinatra's "I Did It My Way."
Uh-huh. There you go.
So he he did it his way.
Yeah, good. Thank you. That was a nice story of courage to, yeah, to just be here. Yes, hi, Stephen.
I once heard that Rahula means hindrance.
Yes.
Why would he name his son Hindrance, and what is he hindering him from?
Rahula, the son of Prince Shakyamuni and Yasodhara, definition would be of that word is fetter, and the other one is half moon. The one that makes it into the literature is fetter, and I'm just going to invite you to let the speculation go. Okay, I think that's another one of those, like, oh my goodness, he ran out on his wife and his newborn son. Okay, I think that's another one like that. And it's like, there are some speculations in the sutras about that, but I don't honestly even want to go there with that, because we're not sure that that's, it's kind of like, like paramita, right? Paramita is usually translated as perfection, which I think is really an unhelpful translation of that. If you move the diacritical mark over one syllable, the translation is other shore, which is much easier to work with than... So I don't know, okay? We don't know, and I think this is one of those to just let go. Okay, I'm sorry. That's the best answer I've got on Rahula. Okay, I will say that even if they thought he was a fetter, my goodness, if all parents raised their children like that, there are three. As long as we're on the topic of Rahula, I highly recommend, these are available by PDF, so you don't need to buy them. The three sutras, the Rahulavada, it's a collection of three sutras. It's the three teachings that the Buddha gave specifically to his son. And all I can say, if you read those and wish that all parents would teach their kids that, the world would be vastly different. So those of you with kids or grandkids or even thinking about it or not thinking about it, okay, I highly recommend the Rahulavada. It's Rahulavada, Rahulavada, the three sermons of the teaching specifically and individually given to his son at 7, 14, and 18, I think. So age-appropriate Dharma, and they're lovely. They're lovely. They really are. They're very inspiring. Very inspiring. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. A couple more. Yes. Rolling along.
I had my midlife crisis about 10 years ago, and at that time I worked with an 84-year-old woman out in Fair Oaks who was somewhat of a who's who among the Rudolf Steiner College community, and she was thoroughly convinced that I was what she called a star child, meaning I was here in my first incarnation. Mm-hmm. I know the following about myself. I'm very poor making decisions. I'm always thinking, oh, there's something, if only I knew that and considered this, then I'd make the right decision. And I have this, over the past week, great envy for Dorothy, the Lion, the Tin Man, and the Scarecrow. Mm-hmm. having each other's hands to hold and having complete faith that their road, the yellow brick road, was the path to travel. Mm-hmm. It's like, how awesome could that be to have community and direction? And I am wanting that. And what I'm sort of imagining, I want to ask you if all those what ifs are really irrelevant, and that it doesn't matter what the circumstances are. What really matters is how you play on. The second unrelated question is, can plants be a part of this conversation? Because I do hear animals, but I don't hear fungus or plants. So I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, so the reason we have Kalyana Mitra, the reason we have the Tin Man and the Lion and the Scarecrow and Dorothy, the reason we have Kalyana Mitra is when we've lost direction. That's when we need them most. Yeah, somebody to hold our hand in the forest. Yeah, and that's why we have each other. We have this practice to hold us together while we fall apart, and we have Kalyana Mitra to hold our hands when it gets dark. As someone mentioned over here, one of the previous incarnations of the Buddha and several people in his Sangha was various forms of plant life. Yeah. Tree deities play a big part in Buddhist literature. It's kind of fun, actually. Yeah, thank you. Can I tell it real quick, the story I told yesterday? Okay, I'm going to tell this really quick. It's one of my favorite ones. So the Sangha is established, and the monks have gone off for the rainy season to find their tree to sit under to meditate. These days we would call this a practice period. So they have gone off to the forest to sit under the trees to meditate, and they start to do this, and the strength of their meditation is really disturbing the deities of the trees. And the deities of the trees have just about had it when they realize that these people are going to be sitting down there for 2 months in this intense concentration and disturbing the deities. So the deities get really upset, and they come down at night and they throw things on the monks, and they cause all kinds of havoc. And the monks, being monks, don't fight back. What they do is they go to their teacher, they go to the Buddha and say, these tree deities are really causing havoc. What are we supposed to do with them? And the Buddha says, practice compassion and chant the Metta Sutta, the loving kindness meditation. So they go back, the monks go back, and they spend, you know, weeks at a time wishing loving kindness, chanting the Metta Sutta for these deities. And the deities are astonished at all the love and outpouring that's coming their way, wafting their way up the trees. And the deities become so enamored of this that they take up the practice of metta and join the practice period. So I love it. Anyway, okay, one more. Hi, Barbara. Nice to see you this evening.
Hi.
Hi.
Nice to see you too.
Thank you.
So, I don't have a sense of past lives so much, but I do have a sense of people that I've been on the path with for a very long time. One was a woman that was, she and I were 3 years old when we met, and we'd been born within 12 hours of each other, and we were on the path until she died. And when she died, I felt like a part of myself just fell away.
Yeah.
It wasn't the same thing as feeling sad or feeling, I mean, I'm not, it's really hard to describe. And then there's another woman that I was in school with, and she moved to Iowa, Lansing, Michigan, etc. But ever since, she, I just feel like when we get together, it's like we've never left each other.
Yeah.
And it's so, and I feel the same way of when people pass, like, I feel like, well, the moon's out tonight, so I can talk to my father, or the stars are out, so that's where mother is. And I do find myself talking to people that have passed a lot. And I guess it's okay to say here.
Thank you. I might edit one thing you said. You said we were friends on the path until we died, and I would like you to hold that lightly. You're still friends on the path. You are. You still are. So when you have situations like Barbara just described, I would say please don't overanalyze it. Okay? If it seems like somebody's been with you for a while, just appreciate the accompaniment. Just appreciate the accompaniment. And don't try to overanalyze it and get all, you know, analytical and is this science or not. It's like in Buddhism, honestly, we aren't quite so concerned about proving the truth of something. What we're really concerned about is, does it reduce suffering or not? That's the deal. And usually Kalyanamitra, the kind that Barbara is describing, are helpful. And we don't need to overanalyze how they got here into our lives. Okay. All right. Thank you all. Ending chant? Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay.